This is NHPR News.
This is Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up, taking flight with Angel Reapers. Sex and stomping play parts in choreographer Martha Clark's latest production based on the radical woman behind the Shakers and appealing to the better angels of our nature. Our 11 for 11 series turns to Harvard professor Steven Pinker on the decline of violence through history and the cognitive benefits of life as peaceful beings. But we begin with the rare musician who can be described as being conservatory caliber, tech virtuosic, literate craftsman, indie cool, and a champion whistler. Critics and fans have shared many more compliments for Andrew Bird since he arrived on the scene in 1996. A singer, composer, and violinist whose music shows a thorough knowledge of jazz, folk, and electronica. Bird's career has meandered through collaborations with the Squirrel Nut Zippers, his former band Bowl of Fire, and numerous film soundtracks, while honing what's become a singular sound. Andrew Bird will be performing at the Capitol Center for the Arts in Concord on October 14th, but he's joining us right now, and we're so pleased to catch him on the road. Andrew, thanks for joining Word of Mouth.
Oh, you're welcome.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your musical journey, which started pretty early. I read that you picked up a violin at the age of four. What was behind it then for you?
My mother had the notion of her kids playing classical music, and I started with the Suzuki method, and I took to it, you know, and I stuck with Suzuki. I learned completely by ear for the first eight years.
Yeah, that was a very popular method, especially back in the 1970s, I'm thinking. Do you think that learning how to play by ear influenced the way that you now hear and compose music?
Oh, for sure, yeah. I mean, I eventually learned from sheer exposure how to read music, but by the time I did, I my ear could always learn a passage faster than my brain, my eyes and my brain could.
Do you think there's a lot of mood, I think, in a lot of your songs, and I wonder if you feel like that's part of what you're writing when you're writing songs. You're kind of creating moods.
I think about, like, textures, and I think when I was, and tone, and when I was little, I would have very visceral reactions to a particular instrument, like a pedal steel would make me feel kind of woozy. It could make me feel carsick, or, you know, I could have these, you know, physical symptoms based on what I was hearing. So I was very into the tone of my instrument, and I would just play one note for an hour and just get into the resonance of it. So I think texture, I guess people talk about synesthesia too, like the seeing colors or thinking of, but I also think of like grains to sound and like a tactile feeling for the sound.
Well, that texture and grain is something that comes alive, especially in the music you've written for soundtracks. Now, I know you wrote the soundtrack to the independent film Norman. It's now making the festival rounds. Let's listen to just one of the songs from that soundtrack. This is called Night Sky.
What if we hadn't been born at the same time? What if you were 75 and I were 9? Would I come visit you? Bring your cookies in an old folks' home. Would you be there alone? When the late summer lightning fires off in your arms, will I remember to breathe? No, I never will. I could convince you that I mean you no harm. Just want to show you how not to need. What if I were the night sky? Here's my lullaby, lullaby to
That's Night Sky from the soundtrack to the film Norman. Our guest, Andrew Bird, composed the album, which is now being released later this month. Andrew, how did you come to work on this film?
I think it was inevitable that I would do a soundtrack, and I would get offers from for different films, and I just waited till one was actually good.
Why did this one appeal to you so much?
Well, it was the first one that was really of any quality at all, and it was and it's a really lovely story. It handles kind of teenage drama, teenage angst with a lot of sensitivity and tact, like, which is kind of rare, you know.
Well, we hear a little bit of your whistling in that song. Whistling has become one of your many signatures. Now, how did that evolve?
I've been doing it casually for years, all the whole time, you know, since I was 5 or 6 years old. And if you hung out with me all day, it would probably drive you nuts.
You'd be like the whistling guy.
If I'm not eating, I'm or occupying my mouth some other way, I'm usually whistling.
Well, I have great admiration for that. I'm one of those people who can't really whistle for beans, and I'm very jealous of it.
It's I like how it's kind of the most casual, tossed off way to make music.
Isn't it funny to solo, though? I mean, you sort of think of people, you know, rock stars on playing air guitar or whatever. You know, there's a lot of, I don't know, movement to it. Whistling, you're just kind of whistling.
You're just whistling. There's a lot of associations with it that you have to sometimes get, you know, there's the sitting on the dock of the bay sort of whimsical whistling. But I also like to use it when I'll loop the violin quite a bit and create like multiple layers of the violin, and the whistle really cuts through these loops of violins in a really nice way.
That's one of the things that people know you for. And also people point out, your critics especially talk about your overwhelming literacy. You know, we actually had a listener on a Facebook page make the same comment. She wanted to know how it is that you manage to incorporate such a range of vocabulary into your songs. She mentioned nomenclature from Noble Beast as an example.
I just follow I'm just curious, you know, and I like to be kind of on the cusp of what I understand myself, you know, with words. And so for a long time I was drawn to words that I didn't quite understand myself, but that had a nice sound to them. And they would lead me down this road. I would have conversations with people. What do you think this word means? And I like those things that are not clear cut, you know, because, you know, the songs just kind of spin from one tangent to the next, and I learn things in the process.
I want to mention another movie soundtrack that you've worked on, the new Muppet movie soundtrack, which is called The Green Album, which is getting an awful lot of buzz. And you were chosen to perform It's Not Easy Being Green. I mean, that's pretty much the plum song of the Muppets. How did you get that one?
I think a lot of people probably avoided it because it belongs to Kermit.
Yeah, how do you make it your own?
I just looked at it like a classic, like a Cole Porter song or something like that. You know, like something from Tin Pan Alley, and just forgot about Kermit for a bit and just thought about what the song is expressing, and treated it like an old jazz tune too, which is a blast to play.
Let's hear just a little bit.
It seems you're blending with all kinds of ordinary things, and people tend to pass you over, 'cause you're not standing out like flashy sparkles in the water or stars in the sky.
Andrew Bird, I really want to thank you for taking some time out to speak with us today.
Oh, you're welcome.
Singer, songwriter, and composer Andrew Bird's latest project is the upcoming soundtrack for the film Norman. That's going to be released on October 11th. He's also going to be performing at the Capitol Center for the Arts in Concord. That's on October 14th. You can find links to more about his music and upcoming shows at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And you can also follow us on Facebook and on Twitter. And coming up, director and choreographer Martha Clark on her vision of stomping, sex, and shakers. That's when Word of Mouth returns. This is NHPR.
Why wonder, I'm green. And that'll do just fine. Besides, it's all I wanna be.
I'm Virginia Prescott. Join me as I sit down with NPR's Guy Raz. He spent nearly a decade as a foreign correspondent in Eastern Europe and throughout the Middle East, and now hosts Weekends on All Things Considered. We'll discuss his transformation from reporter to host and take your questions. Join us at the Tupelo Music Hall in White River Junction, Vermont, on November 15th. Visit nhpr.org to get your tickets.
Made possible with support from TransCanada. Word of Mouth on NHPR. Good Tuesday afternoon. NHPR's fall membership drive begins October 12th, and we're asking you to help out with our kickoff challenge. When we raise $100,000 by the end of the first day of the drive, we'll receive another $12,000 from a group of members. You can help us with the challenge by making a gift today with a phone call to 1-888-805-NHPR or by visiting nhpr.org. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Southern New Hampshire University's online Master of Education program in curriculum and instruction. With 5 high need concentrations and a certification track, snhu.edu. And Tupelo Music Hall, White River Junction, presenting John Lennon Imagine, the benefit performance for Opera North in the Upper Valley Haven on October 9th. TupeloHallVermont.com. New Hampshire weather this afternoon, cloudy, some scattered showers. Today's highs 58 to 63 degrees. Tonight, cloudy, showers ending. Lows tonight 45 to 50 for most of the state, around 40 in the North Country. Tomorrow, turning partly sunny, breezy. Tomorrow's highs from 50 north, ranging to around 60 in southern parts of the state. Thursday, mostly sunny, breezy. Highs 50 north, ranging to 60 in the south. NHPR Daily Weather Reports made possible with support from Public Service of New Hampshire. This is NHPR.
Welcome back to Word of Mouth. Shakers, stomping, and an undercurrent of sex share the stage this weekend at Dartmouth. Director, choreographer, and MacArthur genius Martha Clark's Angel Reapers is a multidimensional work based partly on the life of Mother Ann Lee, founder of the United Society of Believers in Christ's Second Appearing, the radical religious movement known for its ecstatic dancing as Shakers. Martha Clark, we want to welcome you to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
Also joining us is Margaret Lawrence, programming director for The Hop at Dartmouth. Thanks for joining us, Margaret.
You're very welcome.
Martha and Margaret, this may be hard for me to wangle, but you guys can roll with it, I'm sure. Martha, you're quite used to moving with the flow.
I try to.
Well, this isn't your first time at Dartmouth. You've had a long association with the college.
I have. In 1971, my husband, now ex, but a good friend, was artist in residence, and I met the young company Palabolas in the classes of Allison Chase. And so I spent many years here, back and forth to Connecticut with Palabolas. I left the company in 1978. And then the Hop commissioned a work here in the late 90s called Vers la Flamme in collaboration with Lincoln Center, based on the music of Scriabin and the stories of Chekhov.
And now, 40-plus years later, the work that's going to be performed at the Hop this Friday and Saturday night is called Angel Reapers. Now, this was a collaboration, I understand, quite a long time in the making. What was the inspiration?
Alfred Urey, the wonderful playwright who wrote Driving Miss Daisy, and I met at a Thanksgiving party about 6 years ago, and he tapped me on the shoulder. We had barely met and said, "Would you be interested in doing a work on the Shakers?" And I looked at him a bit cross-eyed, and I said, "Sure." And we went to Andre Bishop at Lincoln Center Theater, who gave us a very extended developmental time. Alfred wrote a play, and I worked on the choreography and staging, but the piece turned out to be too much of a, I think we thought, a bio flick. It was too biographical and too linear. And we gave it a rest for many years, and now here we are about to give birth on Friday night to Angel Reapers. Well, it's been a very long process.
And for me, it's funny to imagine. I mean, you're known for directing classical operas, you know, pushing beyond choreography to create a lot of sets, a lot of theatricality, emotionality, maybe most well-known for your piece, The Garden of Earthly Delights, based on Hieronymus Bosch. Well, Delights, I think, is at the core here. I mean, it's about excesses. Now, Shakers we think of as spare, kind of simple, kind of rigid. What drew you in?
Well, I've never done an American subject, so that was one thing. Two is that I am a New Englander myself. I live in northwestern Connecticut and have always been extremely drawn to the austerity and simplicity and beauty of Shaker furniture and design. And when we started to delve into the music, I was so taken with the authentic 18th century hymns and chorales. And it's been a completely compelling subject, and I even still brought up a book here to read at night on the Shakers because I have trouble letting go. Mm.
Margaret, Shakers, of course, have a very strong history here in New Hampshire. Did that play a role in your decision at the Hop to bring Angel Reapers?
It certainly excited me, although I think that Martha Clark is the kind of artist where if she has a new project, she's really such a profound voice and such a visionary artist that the Hop, you know, wants to be part of helping with whatever she may have cooking. But it then also really excited me to try to make the connections to the local Enfield Shaker community.
Give us a little background on the story, if you would, Martha. What's going on in Angel Reapers?
Well, I call it a tone poem. Now that we're not doing a play, it is a look at the community founded by Mother Ann Lee. She was a shaking Quaker in Manchester, England, in the 1730s. She had four stillborn children, and eventually with her husband, who was a blacksmith. And she had a vision of America, and she had a vision that sex was evil. I think the despair and horror of having all her children die perhaps caused this vision to believe that chastity was the only way to God and to spirituality. So the show begins in a Shaker meeting. They laughed, they danced, they sing. They had very unique ways in the early days of the Shaker community of worshiping. After Mother Ann died, into the about 50 years after she died, the Shaker community hit its height in terms of influence. Also, the singing and dancing became much more codified. Mm. It's fascinating to read about it because the early Shaker worship was rather bizarre and very, very individual. And as the Shaker community spread in America and existed for strongly for about 60 years, the dancing became codified. They're beautiful 19th century engravings of groups of people with their hands hanging like dog paws, moving in lines and circles. So we've kind of done a compressed 50-year interpretation of the Shakers. Mother Ann Lee is at the center of the wheel, and it's her inspiration, her vision that made the religion. She had an extremely strong and tender affection for her brother William, who had been a cavalry officer and married, and he gave all this up to call his sister mother. It's a strange religion, but there's something so beautiful about the purity of the community. Also, given that it took root during the American Revolution, that it was a matriarchal society and a utopian society is really quite unusual.
It is really fascinating to read about, you know, and be reminded about it in this production. An egalitarian society, men and women were mostly equal. But let's hear a little bit of the dialogue. There's actually dialogue in this performance. Here's a clip from a live performance of Angel Reapers. This is from the American Drama Festival at Duke last year. And the recording is from offstage, so it's certainly not perfect.
Husbands and wives must forsake their marriage vows and cast them asunder. We must learn that what they believe to be love is not love. It is lust. Vile, beastly lust.
So what's going on here? Husbands and wives must forsake their marriage vows, you know, not give in to vile, beastly lust. The dancers also sing. Now, this is pretty startling for a group of dancers. Martha Clark, how did they feel about doing this?
Well, intimidated. They have had a wonderful music director who was also my music director for Garden of Earthly Delights, Arthur Solari. He has coached and trained them. They sing the entire score a cappella. Most of the dancers have never acted on stage before. They're doing their text beautifully and movingly. We had a fabulous vocal coach named Richard Armstrong, who's an internationally renowned vocal coach in the theater. And so they've picked up new skills along the way. I think the singing is hard for them, but it's kind of an amazing thing to see some of these extraordinary dancers from New York City acting and singing. We have a new mother, Ann Lee, a wonderful actress named Birgit Hupak, who got an Obie last year in New York for a play called Telephone. So she's only been rehearsing with us 3 weeks, but I'm amazed at what a force she is in the production already.
Well, Margaret, you're at the Hop, and I know people who may not know Martha's work. What can they expect to see in this production?
Well, as Martha says, it is a work that really brings you that sense of the ecstasy of this group. It is a very visually stripped down and yet really beautiful production. The lighting, there's these very kind of austere but beautiful costumes. Martha's work, I think, is so often inspired by visual art, and I don't think that's not true here as well. It really brings back all sorts of images, and I think it's just absolutely captivating.
Margaret Lawrence, Program Director for the Hop, the Hopkins Center for the Art, that's at Dartmouth University. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Martha Clark, choreographer and director. Her work, Angel Reapers, will be performed on Friday and Saturday night at the Hop. You're listening to music from the production now, and there's more information at wordofmouthradio.org.
Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and the Art of the Americas Wing at the Museum of Fine Arts, Boston. Masterpieces from ancient gold and colonial treasures to modern photography. Details at mfa.org. And the Turner Group of Concord, architects, engineers, and building scientists celebrating over 20 years of creating sustainable buildings for a healthy environment. Online at hlturner.com. It's 12:30. This is NHPR.
BBC News with Jerry Smith. Medical workers in Somalia say at least 70 people have been killed in a suicide bomb attack in the capital Mogadishu. 50 others were wounded. A truck packed with explosives was driven at the Ministry of Higher Education. Reports say the explosion was so powerful that body parts landed hundreds of metres away. The leaders of India and Afghanistan have signed a new strategic partnership to expand cooperation in security and development. Speaking in Delhi, the Indian Prime Minister, Dr. Manmohan Singh, said he had detailed and frank discussions about terrorism with the visiting Afghan President Hamid Karzai. The Russian Prime Minister, Vladimir Putin, has called for closer integration of former Soviet republics along the lines of the European Union. Mr. Putin proposed what he called a Eurasian Union, but he denied any ambition to recreate the Soviet Union. A woman who runs a pub in England has won a legal battle against the English Premier League over the public screening of football matches. The European Court of Justice ruled that national legislation, which stopped Karen Murphy using a Greek satellite decoder at her pub rather than a British one, went against the EU's freedom to provide services. For a second day in a row, shares in Europe have fallen sharply amid renewed concerns that Greece may not pay all its debts. Banks exposed to Greek government debts suffered the greatest losses. A new study is warning of the huge costs of brain disease in Europe. An umbrella organisation representing scientists, doctors and patients says the $1 trillion annual cost of treating conditions ranging from migraines to dementia outstrips the cost of cancer care. This year's Nobel Prize for Physics has been won by three scientists for their pioneering work on supernovas. American cosmologists Saul Perlmutter and Adam Rees and US-Australian Brian Schmidt concluded that dark energy is accelerating the expansion of the universe. BBC News.
This is Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. A few weeks ago, we spoke with the scholar Joshua Goldstein about this startling decrease in the number of people dying from conflict over the past generation. Today, we continue our 11 for 11 series of interesting, innovative thinkers on the issues of our day with Steven Pinker. Steven Pinker is an experimental psychologist, one of the world's foremost writers on language, the mind, and human nature, and he joins us for the long view of the evolution of violence in the public and private lives of humans, from waging wars to spankings. Pinker lays out statistics, neuroscientific research, and quotes from Homer as he charts the trajectory from the nasty, brutish, and short lives endured by our ancestors to horror and outrage in response to random shootings today. His book is called The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined, and it's just out today. And we welcome Steven Pinker to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
Well, it's a very big book.
It's a very big topic, and I had to start out just by convincing people that there's a phenomenon to be explained, because most people think that violence has increased. So I had a tough sell.
Yeah, it sort of counters, you know, the way that we talk about the violent world that we live in today. But you cover centuries of human life, you know, this litany of unspeakable horrors of the evil that men do. What were some of the revelations for you in researching those?
One was just how much the rates have come down when you try to measure them quantitatively. We all have images of native peoples living in harmony with nature and with each other. But if you count the number of violent deaths as a proportion of all deaths, it averages to about 15%. Now, what's the rate of violent death in the 20th century? Throwing in all the world wars, the genocides, the smaller wars, the man-made famines, it's about 3%, one-fifth the rate.
Go ahead.
Just to give one other example, in medieval Europe, the homicide rate was about 35 times higher than what it is today. So the images of people dancing around the maypole with flowing gowns and drinking mead covers up a very violent way of life.
Well, there are several changes and factors in how humans organize themselves that altered the danger in their lives, like from nomadic to hunter-gatherers. So what are some of these benchmarks?
Well, the appearance of the state and a government brings rates of violence down. When you outsource justice to a more or less disinterested third party, then you don't have the cycles of feuding and vendetta that you have in anarchic societies. Then, of course, you've got the problem of the violence that the state commits against its own citizens. And that leads to another transition, namely democracy, which is constraining the power of the Leviathan, the central state, to do violence against its citizens. That brings violence down even further. Probably trade and commerce change the incentive structure so that it can be cheaper to buy something than to plunder it, and other people are more valuable alive than dead. And also education, literacy, cosmopolitanism, travel, all of the forces of modernity that allow you to see the world through other people's points of view, to broaden your horizons, makes it a little bit harder to privilege your own group and to demonize everyone in the other group.
So if we have been following this continuing trajectory, how does the brutality of the 20th century, you know, Stalin, the Holocaust, Rwanda, fit in? Is this a setback?
It is a setback, and it's important not to mistake one event with a trend, which many people did. Everyone assumed, well, you got World War I, maybe 15 million deaths. World War II, maybe 50 million deaths. So clearly, we're just getting ready for World War III that'll have even more deaths because of nuclear superpowers. But of course, World War III didn't happen, and so the idea that there was a trend turned out to be mistaken. What you have in the history of great power war is that the wars actually over 500 years became less and less common, although the ones that did happen were more and more destructive until World War II, when the destructionists did a U-turn, and ever since then, wars have become less frequent and less destructive.
We're speaking with Steven Pinker. He's our guest for the 11 for 11 series today, and we're talking about the decrease in violence over human history. He has a new book out today called The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined. Well, the better angels may be calling upon the role of reason, considering consequences. And you show a sort of interest in, a decrease of interest or glorification of violence. What's behind that?
I think there's been an accelerating trend since the Enlightenment to think of the flourishing of individual human beings as the ultimate good. And everything else, the tribe, the nation, the religion, are, to the extent they're good at all, they're good because they make people better off rather than worse off. Now, this sounds just like so obvious to us. It almost sounds like just feel-good, you know, treacle. But in fact, it's a radical idea because in most times and places, it's the glorification of the nation, the race, the tribe, the religion that has been paramount, and individual people are just like cells in a body. So the inversion, where you say human beings are the ultimate value, was slow to catch on and still hasn't caught on in a lot of the world.
So let's look at this post-1945 period of what you call the new peace or the long peace, an unprecedented avoidance of war. And in 1948, the UN Declaration of Human Rights, leading to what you're calling the rights revolution period of today. What does that mean?
Since 1948, there's been a cascade of revolutions. The civil rights revolution, women's rights, children's rights, gay rights, now even animal rights, which expanded the circle of concern to embrace wider and wider bodies of or groups of sentient agents. The idea was that if each one of these revolutions used the preceding one as a kind of analogy, that after the civil rights movement, women were saying, well, gee, if it's not good to discriminate against racial minorities, why should it be okay to discriminate against women? And that's what the gay rights activists thought. And in each case, these movements did succeed in bringing rates of violence down. Lynchings have been eliminated, hate crimes are down, rape is down, spousal abuse, child abuse, violence in the playground. Each one of these has actually worked. They weren't just kind of feel-good verbiage.
The contemporary violence that we hear about a lot about today, car bombs in Iraq, suicide bombs in Afghanistan or Pakistan, women being raped and killed in the Democratic Republic of Congo. You point out some very interesting correlations between the treatment of women and homosexuals. You just mentioned some of those. But this idea that a happier, healthier society is more peaceful. So do we know which comes first?
We don't really. The problem is if you compare societies, lots of good things go together. Wealth, health, education, peace, empowerment of women. And then there are societies where a lot of bad things go together. Poverty, disease, war, persecution of minorities, violent treatment of women. So we don't know how to get the virtuous circle started. But it's not a bad idea to start with violence itself, because even if poverty causes war, war also causes poverty by killing productive people, destroying productive facilities. And Josh Goldstein, who you had on the show previously, mm-hmm. I think sums it up well. It said, instead of the bumper sticker that says, if you want peace, work for justice, you should replace it with, if you want peace, work for peace. Hmm. But just getting all sides to lay down their arms is certainly a good first step.
Steven Pinker is with us for our 11 for 11 series today. He's a cognitive neuroscientist and author of the new book, The Better Angels of Our Nature. He's challenging our assumptions about living in a brutal and violent world. Steven Pinker, please stay with us. We're going to be back after a short break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR.
Your help today will kick off NHPR's fall membership drive. We have a challenge to raise $100,000 by the end of the first day of the drive. When we do, we'll receive an additional $12,000 from a group of dedicated members. So your donation today helps us with the challenge. And it also puts your name in the hat for a special drawing for a trip to Las Vegas, Nevada. Make a gift on our website, nhpr.org, or call 1-888-805-6477.
You're listening to Word of Mouth on NHPR. Thanks for spending some time with us on a Tuesday afternoon. Coming up on Here and Now this afternoon, the Occupy Wall Street movement has spread to other cities. What do protesters want? Also, teaching foreign-born doctors how to treat patients in Iowa, including classes on how to talk about the Hawkeyes and farming. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, Here and Now, coming up at 1 on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and from Meredith Village Savings Bank, proud to serve the people and communities of central New Hampshire for over 140 years. Online at mvsb.com. And the Colonial Theater in Keene presenting The Kings of Salsa, blending contemporary dance and Cuban classics, October 11th. Tickets and information now at thecolonial.org. New Hampshire weather this afternoon, cloudy with some scattered showers. Today's high temperatures, 58 to 63 degrees. Tonight, cloudy, showers ending, lows from 45 to 50, most of the state around 40 in the North Country. Tomorrow, it'll be turning partly sunny and breezy, with highs from 50 north ranging to around 60 southern parts of the state. Thursday, a mostly sunny, breezy day, highs from 50 north ranging to 60 in the south. And for Friday, partly sunny, highs 55 north, ranging to around 65 in southern New Hampshire. This is NHPR.
Welcome back to Word of Mouth.
10 ought to do it, don't you think? You think we need one more? All right, we'll get one more.
The numbers all go to 11.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
11. You're on 10 on your guitar. Where can you go from there?
11.
And most of
11.
The
amps go up to 10.
Well, today we're bringing it up, turning it up to 11 for our 11 for 11 series of big thinkers and innovative perspectives on the issues of our time. Today, Steven Pinker, one of the world's foremost writers on language, the mind, and human nature. And we're talking about his new book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined, which combines statistics and brain science, war studies, game theory, and popular culture in an exploration of where violence comes from and why we are more humane now than at any time in history. Well, Steven Pinker, your background is an experimental psychologist, cognitive neuroscientist. You bring up these fascinating questions of how violence engages our psychology. Is our vision of violence distorted? And why are we so pessimistic about it?
Well, absolutely it's distorted. There are, before the break, ran through a list of trouble spots in the world. And since violence hasn't declined to zero, you can always find them. And there are always enough violent incidents to fill the evening news. But what you didn't mention was what's happening in Angola and Mozambique and Poland and Northern Ireland and Nicaragua and all of these places that had horrific rates of violence in the past. When these places have outbreaks of peace, there isn't a reporter around to cover it. No one would be interested in watching footage of people dying in bed of peaceful causes. And so since the mind estimates risk by how easily it can recall examples, we're apt to think that we live in a violent world. In fact, as the ability to report and film violence increases, now anyone with a cell phone can take video footage and beam it to the world, we might even think that violence has increased, whereas as a proportion of the population, it's decreased.
So if we are looking at the evolution of the human brain, is it that violence is something, you know, that we're getting rid of? It's being abolished like smallpox?
It's possible, but I doubt it, because evolution has a speed limit that's measured in generations, and many of these declines have taken place over a span of decades or even years, too fast for it to be a biological change. I think instead it's that our changed environment is engaging a fixed human nature in different ways.
So if there's an idea that violence is engaged in this kind of self-perpetuating or self-reinforcing way, can peace also be engaged in that way?
Yes, because often if you're surrounded by bullies, you have no choice but to be a bully too, just for self-preservation. You can often have downward spirals where if a whole community becomes less violent, it ratchets down the pressure on everyone, which then lifts the pressure on everyone else in a kind of virtuous circle. And so an example is just Canada and the United States, which fought a number of wars in the early 19th century. But now the idea of war between Canada and the U.S. is kind of a joke. Neither one stays up at night worrying about trouble from the other. And that can happen even across even larger neighborhoods like Western Europe.
Well, that's now, but there are people like Michael Pollan and others predict that climate change is going to make resources ever more scarce and have us battling for water and resources in the future.
It's possible, but it is not inevitable. It's certainly highly likely that climate change will lead to a lot of human misery. Whether it will lead to war, though, is not automatic. Most wars are not fought over competition for resources, and many competitions for resources don't result in war. There have been a lot of droughts and famines that that have not triggered wars, and then you go over history, you try to figure out what was World War I about. It wasn't like they were fighting over dwindling water or strategic minerals. Wars are often fought or have to be instigated by some kind of political leadership for some reason. And often the reasons have to do with glory and honor and pride and rectifying historic injustices, all kinds of things that have nothing to do with food and water and land.
Honor is something that you write about in the book. The change in our vision of honor has actually changed our capacity for peace. Can you illuminate that for us?
Yeah, honor is a fancy schmancy word for deterrence. Credible deterrence. That is, you are tough enough and have enough resolve that if someone messes with you, you'll retaliate, which, of course, is intended to deter them from wanting to attack you in the first place. And there are environments where you have no choice but to cultivate a sense of honor, basically environments under anarchy. But when you do have a set of laws and norms and third parties enforcing justice, then honor can be self-defeating. And it can lead to all those police blotter homicides where someone blows someone else away because they fought over a parking spot or they were insulted in a bar. And the international equivalent, where you have countries going to war to preserve their honor, often at a cost of hundreds of thousands of lives, something that I think the world is moving away from.
So that's a question. Has our cultural view caught up with what's going on a much larger scale, the statistics, the trends that you point to? Do we still see ourselves as violent creatures? Or maybe is there a danger in thinking that we are less violent, that we, you know, imagine a Mad Max scenario in the future? If we let our guard down now, if we stop having that sort of edge and need for competition, would that be to our detriment?
Well, I think thinking that the world is more dangerous than it is can have its hazards. One of them is you think you have to be belligerent to defend yourself against enemies. To the extent that the enemies aren't as aggressive as you fear, then you might be less likely to provoke a dangerous escalation. Of course, it's a fine line to walk because you also don't want to be naive about the people who really do have violent designs on you. And more generally, there is also, I think, an advantage to be gained in knowing how much we can bring violence down. You have to read the headlines about Africa and think, oh, they're always going to be at each other's throats. It's a hellhole. Why even bother to bring peace to Africa? It's just a fool's errand. But if you look at the statistics, and you show that in Africa, the rate of war and the rate of death of war have come down, you're thinking, well, gee, someone's been doing something right. Let's try to figure out exactly what it is and do more of it.
And this trumpeting this by peace workers especially comes across as a kind of trajectory towards, what did you call it in the book, a moral saga, you know, that we are becoming more civil, we are becoming more humane through history. Is that what's happening?
I think liken it to technological change. We live longer, we travel farther, we travel faster, we hold more books and music on our iPods. And we also figure out ways of driving violence down. Violence is great if you're the victor, not so great if you're the loser. The trick is, how do you get everyone to decide that this is a losing game and get everyone to give up violence at the same time so no one has to be violent to protect themselves? That's an intellectual and technological, and you can even think of it as a scientific challenge. And slowly and haltingly and with lots of trial and error, I think our species has been getting better and better at solving that problem.
In your book, The Blank Slate, there's this maybe a more tragic view, I'm not sure, that genetically we're disposed to being quarrelsome, competitive, especially when fueled by ideology. Has your view changed?
Well, I emphasize in this book a theme that was mentioned in The Blank Slate, although only in a few paragraphs, namely that I think we are always saddled with those ugly parts of human nature, and we're always going to need safeguards against them. That's why I'm not an anarchist. I don't think that we're going to be able to do without the police, and I'm not a unilateral pacifist. I don't think that armies should be disbanded. On the other hand, we do have parts of human nature that can counteract those ugly bits, and we can jigger our environments to try to bring out the, as Abraham Lincoln called them, the better angels of our nature.
Well, Steven Pinker, a lot to think about. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Steven Pinker, experimental psychologist, Harvard professor, is continuing his inquiry into human nature with a new book detailing the decrease in violence throughout human history. It's a broad and thorough work that shows that humans are becoming more humane and is called The Better Angels of Our Nature. It's out today from Viking. You can find more on the book, including reviews and links to some of his talks at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also ride on the peace train on Facebook and on Twitter. Thanks for joining us for several facets of the human condition today. We'll be back again tomorrow at noon, again at 9, with more Word of Mouth from NHPR.
It's Marketplace Tech Report from APM, American Public Media. I'm John Moe. Net neutrality will soon be the law of the land or strangled by litigation. The FCC just published rules on net neutrality. Broadband providers must move all internet traffic at the same speed, nothing blocked or slowed. Wireless carriers can slow traffic and can block it as long as it's not from a competing service like Skype or Google Voice. The rules are supposed to go into effect next month, but a bunch of new lawsuits might delay that. Citizens groups have sued over the wireless exception. Verizon sued, saying there shouldn't be any rules. Technology consultant Larry Downs says litigation will be a stumbling block.
Well, a lot of this, of course, is just posturing. I mean, most of these groups are really trying to make sure that they get the case heard in a court that they think is going to be most friendly to them. In the short term, it means the courts will probably hold up the implementation of the rules until the litigation is resolved. So likely is that the rules will probably never go into effect.
Down says the FCC is in over its head.
The big problem is that the FCC has never had the authority to do much at all with the internet. That was, I think, very clear from the last big rewrite of the telecom law in 1996. And they don't have much experience. They don't have much authority to deal with the internet revolution. Well, of course, since 1996, everything has changed in terms of, you know, their traditional things of doing with broadcast, with telephone. All these things have converged onto the internet. The FCC wants to have a role to play in regulating all this activity, but Congress has not rewritten the law to give them that authority.
The rules might not matter just yet. Andrew McLaughlin is a lecturer at Stanford Law School. He says we pretty much have an open internet at the moment, but streaming video is growing fast, a lot of money on the line, and that's where you and I will see this war being fought.
The first area where you might notice something happening is if your broadband provider at home starts to offer you special rates on their video programming services as opposed to, say, Netflix. When you think about the ability to just sit down and choose any program you want out of a vast library and watch it at any device in any location, the convenience is so dramatic that the market uptake of services like Netflix has been so tremendous that I think we can see both more growth in that direction and more panicky defensiveness on the part of video programming providers. And where those companies also own broadband service providers, they're going to be looking at how to use those broadband networks to maintain as long as possible the revenue streams they've gotten used to from their cable channels.
Andrew McLaughlin from Stanford Law School. There's a new iPhone on the way. Everyone will go nuts and want one. And in a year, Apple will launch another new iPhone, and everyone will go nuts for that one, too. Where does it end? Maybe Denmark. Thomas Møller Jensen is founder of a company called Acer, which has a new phone out. It ain't cheap, starts around $8,000, but it's built to last for at least 20 years.
Which is the opposite of what we have today, where every year, 1.3 billion mobile phones are designed and made basically entirely by plastic. They are designed to last 12 to 18 months, after which we throw them away. And they end as landfills somewhere in a third world country.
The phone doesn't do web or email or Angry Birds. It's the anti-iPhone.
Some of these people that buy our phones, they don't want to be reminded that there's an unread email coming in every other second. They just need a mobile phone so their loved ones can call them. And that's all.
Thomas Møller Jensen of Acer. This is Marketplace Tech Report. I'm John Moe.
Marketplace Tech Report is supported by Best Buy for Business. Always thinking of ways to help your business be ready for anything. More at bestbuy.com/business. Tomorrow on Word of Mouth, Uprooted. A new documentary features stories of refugees resettled in New Hampshire. We'll hear firsthand from those writing new chapters in immigration history. And the dodgy rise and mysterious disappearance of two software scammers. I'm Virginia Prescott. It takes all kinds on Word of Mouth. Tomorrow at noon and again at 9 p.m. on NHPR.
Here and now, next at 1 o'clock on NHPR, where support comes from you, our members, and from GDS Associates, engineers and consultants offering homeowners and businesses energy efficiency audits and advice on renewable energy. GDSAssociates.com/NH. And the annual Sandwich Fair and Center Sandwich, October 8th, 9th, and 10th, New Hampshire's last traditional country fair with fun for the whole family, thesandwichfair.com. These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio, WEVO Concord 89.1, WEVS Nashua 88.3.